Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
And our best of week continues from the Sunbury Motors Studio, Sunbury Motors Ford Lincoln Hyundai in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia on the strip, routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf. Sean Carey here. Steve will be back on Monday. Miss any of our shows live on WKOK, we invite you to subscribe to our Steve Jones Show podcast, available on both Google Play, iTunes, Apple Podcast app, and 3 months of shows are always archived at stevejonesshow.com. And we always love to get into the business side of sports, so we always turn to our expert, the CEO of Spotlight Ticket Management and invitemanager.com, Tony Knopp.
The World Cup is coming up. Obviously, the nations will come together, but it's in Russia. There'll be no United States. How do you view that right now? How does the corporate world view it?
It's going to be a very interesting World Cup. The Russian soccer gangs, which is a real thing, have taken to social media and made it very, very clear that England is not welcome in Russia, either for the Champions League finals or for the World Cup. And without the United States being there, the question is going to be how much of England is going to be there and what kind of focus you're going to see on Mexico. So, for example, you know, Fox paid $1.2 billion for the rights to a lot of the major soccer that happens over the course of the next 12 years. And if you watch, you know, all their commercials are around El Tri, around, you know, Team Mexico. So I think there's not going to be that much coverage in the United States, to be totally honest. I don't know if people are going to care all that much. And I'm actually really worried about the security issue there. I talked to two of the top five major sponsors of the Champions League and World Cup, and they're just not sending people. And the other is a major technology company that is anywhere from 1,000 to 5,000 people at the World Cup, and they said they'll have maybe a dozen people there. It's just not safe.
Wow.
I expected it to be bad, but when they told me that, I thought, wow, I don't know who's going to go then.
Well, the part about the Russian gang versus, obviously, England, I knew about. Hadn't talked about it on the show, but knew about. But this goes far deeper, I think, than anybody realizes.
It's going to be incredibly dangerous and very, very nasty. I mean, a quick Google search or YouTube search will show you what they're already doing to each other. And the idea of, you know, an English team possibly being in Kiev for the Champions League if Liverpool holds on, and then England going to the World Cup, it's going to be, you know, people shouldn't be leaving the major cities. And even at that point, I don't know if I'd want to be traveling around the England contingent, to be honest. And the reality is, when you have a World Cup in a place like Russia, you know, similar to having it in South Africa, you're really, really relying on those European countries. And England travels better than almost all of them, especially if the team is good. So you're literally taking one of your top five fan bases and saying, you're not welcome here. It's going to have a major economic impact on the World Cup.
Plus, you already don't have Italy.
Right. You don't have Italy, you don't have the Dutch. You're basically saying England's not welcome. So you're relying on, you know, the German contingent, the Spanish contingent, the team's getting a little old there, to bring enough economic impact and economic influence to you. You know, the Americans aren't going out there. The team's not even in it. So it's going to be a really fascinating World Cup. I mean, I appreciate the fact they're trying to make it a global game and that, you know, teams like Egypt and, you know, teams from Asia that probably aren't in the top 30 are getting in. But now it's getting to the point where they're kind of cutting off their nose to spite their face, you know. I mean, the Dutch are the runners-up two of the last three times. They're not even in the tournament.
Right. There's something interesting going on, and it's with Big Ten Network. Outside the Big Ten footprint, Comcast has dropped the Big Ten Network. Now, you and I both know that 10-year deal that they signed, it's up this year. This is year 10, so this is the 10-year deal. And you and I both know that the negotiations continue to be stalled, that next will be the Big Ten footprint. I wouldn't be surprised if the first couple of weeks of the football season there's no Big Ten Network on Comcast. That's just an opinion. It's not fact. What in today's cable market, where you're still getting into 70 million plus homes, that's not a small number.
Yeah, oh yeah.
What's the effect of these negotiations? What do leagues want, or a league network want, and what does Comcast want?
Well, you know, the problem is they're trying to figure out how to measure what's happening right now. I mean, the reality is they still haven't found an effective way to understand who's watching across multiple, you know, viewership, whether it's you're watching on your tablet, whether you're watching it mobile, or whether you're watching it in a traditional sense. So even their ratings right now aren't really something that they can rely on. And we're all hearing about cord cutting and people getting away from live TV, but, you know, sports continues to maintain. You know, the one thing that's going to be interesting to watch with the Big Ten Network is they're kind of first here. They were the first ones to set up a regional network that was as powerful as it is. And a regional sports network that was as powerful as it is. And so, you know, the Pac-12 and others have kind of piggybacked off of that. It'll be interesting to see how well they hold the line because, you know, a lot of people believe, you know, there's just no way I'm going to miss Penn State football for the first month if I'm on Comcast. Comcast would never do that to me. Well, I'd invite you to come out here and try to catch a Dodger game on Time Warner, who's the number two provider in Southern California. We haven't had Dodger games locally in over two seasons, and the Dodgers went to the World Series last year. So, I mean, we're not talking about, you know, a public relations issue here. And the cable companies are already not well-liked. They're not that concerned about you not liking them anymore. What they're more interested about is, you know, the hundreds of millions of dollars that are going back and forth in this negotiation and making sure that they're not missing out on how the next generation is going to consume what they're watching. Because, honestly, they don't really even know. And, you know, kudos to the Big Ten Network. I mean, the reality is it's extremely powerful. The fans are very, very loyal. And as people move to a different form and different platform for entertainment, sports has helped. So, you know, they know they're sitting on something valuable. I just hope it doesn't affect people in Big Ten country because, you know, that would be a shame. It's, you know, the best time of the year.
Right. No, it's, you know, and that's happened with other groups before. Remember CBS got into a big go-around with Comcast about carriage fees and how much it's going to cost per CBS affiliate on
The biggest nightmare
on the
that's
bill and so forth.
Houston. The Houston Rockets and the Houston Astros decided to build their own network because they didn't like the way the negotiations were going with Fox and some of the other major players. And they built their own network, and the two of them said, yeah, there'll be no problem with having both of us, you know, in charge. And what happened? It completely tanked. They ended up suing one another. The games fell off the air for, you know, well over a year between two major market teams. And just now they're back to where they started. They signed an outsourced deal where they have a you know, network company now covering it and handling it for them. So, you know, there's a lot at stake here, and there's a lot of precedent for people who have really messed this up. And, you know, I think a lot of times when we see this, we think, you know, these are major brands, and they know what they're doing, and they're not going to interrupt the football season. But actually, precedent says otherwise.
Well, now I want to bring the Dodger part up, Tony, because you brought that up. I remember a couple of years ago, they had taught somebody said, well, gee, you know, they've got Vin Scully as well as the Dodgers. And they still can't get on. And Scully, to his credit, said, hey, look, my job's to announce the games. It's not my job to, you know, people shouldn't be watching just for me. So what is, in Los Angeles, where the Dodgers are as established a brand as you could possibly ask for, what is the rub? Why can't the two sides come to an agreement?
It just comes down to money. The Dodgers, when they bought, when Guggenheim and the partners bought the Dodgers, you know, the understanding was they put a valuation on that deal, on the network deal, and how much they were going to be able to make both locally and internationally. You know, the Dodgers have aspirations of being an international brand. They believe that they're the number two brand behind the Yankees. And, you know, you and I would laugh about that now because that just hasn't been the case for the last 20 years. But, you know, 1988 and prior, they were the number two brand in baseball. So, you know, they have aspirations to get that, back to that point. And, you know, Time Warner is just saying, look, this doesn't add up, right? You're trying to hold us hostage and you're trying to turn our fans against us. But it's gotten to the point now where it's so stale. You know, you go to sports bars around here and there are signs up that say, we don't have Time Warner. You can watch Dodger games. Or we do have Time Warner. You can watch Dodger games, right? It's giving them the opportunity to say, look, Time Warner is going to use this as an example to try to drive new subscribers, and they've dug their feet in the sand. They've already gotten past the publicity backlash for it. It's almost become a normal thing here. And I personally do know people who've converted over so they can watch Dodger games. And I think we're going to have the same kind of chicken at the Big 12 Network. And that's just going to set the precedent for what happens everywhere else because all of these other networks are looking to the Big 12 Network as the gold standard, right? The SEC can talk about how great they are, but the business side for them, it's just not there. They're too reliant on their major network deal, right? And they don't control their own product. So this will be a fascinating one to watch, because this isn't just about the Big 12 network. This is about every major regional network that's come up since they pioneered this.
Okay, let me ask you about the millennial group. And we've talked about this before, but I'll try it in a different vein. You know, you're somebody that's in the ticket business, you're in the business of business. What is it about the millennial group that people, in your opinion, don't get? And are there actually traditional ways of getting media to them that people haven't understood that they're more? I'll give you a good example. A lot of people think you have to have great Wi-Fi in the stadium because millennials want it, and they could care less about it.
They don't care.
When you actually talk to them.
All the studies show that they don't care.
You're trying to think with them. So when you've gone through and done your research, what does it tell you?
Millennials are about experiences, and they're way less about brands, right? It's the reality that we're seeing with them across their ticket buying preferences and where they attend and what they do. You know, we're all still significantly brand-driven based on how advertising has evolved from, you know, the 50s until today. And we're loyal to specific brands for no other reason but just something that we subconsciously understand. But they've been so inundated since the day they were born and had so much access to information that they're not loyal to specific brands. They're actually even less loyal to teams. And that comes from the fact that they've been exposed to entire leagues instead of just the local team on one of their 18 channels. So what they're really struggling with is not how to get millennials to attend when your team is good and when it's neat. You know, you were talking about the 76ers. You know, they've built something that's now crossed over into pop culture, and, you know, millennials attend Sixers games. But the problem was most highlighted with we saw with the University of Michigan a few years back when they couldn't get students to even go to the game.
Right?
And that to Generation X and to the baby boomers is alien, because, you know, to us, the game is part of a community. We go to all of them, and that's something that we do because they're there. And millennials just say, look, this experience just really isn't that separated from the other experiences that I'm having. When the team is good and unique, I'll go, but otherwise I'm not going to go watch, you know, a crappy team play. And that's been the biggest problem, is the actual ticket buying trends have become more about experience than they have become about even the band or even the team playing. Like, people are more interested now in Coachella than even who's on the lineup for Coachella.
Right.
Coachella, for those that don't know, is a very large music festival that happens in Southern California 2 weekends a year. That it's the largest in the world now, and everybody's trying to back up on that. And it's become this large corporate thing where the brands are trying to find a way into the millennials, but the millennials just go because it's become this Woodstock-like getaway for their generation.
Right. Exactly. Now, I'll give you an example. Georgia football 3 years ago. Georgia football.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, 29% no-show rate among students who had already bought tickets.
That's unheard of.
Arizona State, 48%.
Arizona State, I understand. It's, you know, the West Coast, as much as I love it, the West Coast is soft when it comes to football. But for SEC country and Big Ten country to have that happen at Georgia and Michigan, it's absurd. And it's not just absurd. It's something that is a very big problem for, you know, universities who rely on ticketing gate. Like, you know, the 76ers are a lot less reliant on people buying tickets to their events than Georgia and Michigan are. It's just the way it is. You know, universities have moved slower than the leagues have in trending towards activating sponsors around different kinds of things. They really rely on you attending the game, and they haven't yet evolved. And millennials are not going to support them. That's just the reality. They're not going to go unless the team's good. And even if the team's good, if they've been good for a long time and it's not a new experience with, you know, a new superstar that people find enticing, they're not going to go. I mean, USC games, the minute USC lost a game this year, attendance dropped by 15%.
Yep, exactly. Right. Now, if you're advising Jeremy Pruitt of Tennessee, do you tell him to not challenge the fans who didn't show up at your spring game?
I mean, I don't know what the answer is for Tennessee. That was a program that was winning national championships 20 years ago. That has just been a doormat. I mean, one bad hire after another. At what point do you say, look, we've lost a fan base? We've lost an entire generation of a fan base. Because that's happened across the country. I mean, you and I have seen it. Teams that were once, you know, superpowers are just now largely ignored, right? Remember when Seton Hall was a basketball superpower and everybody wanted to go? That's not the case anymore. And Georgetown's getting to that point now, where they used to be a must-see, and they played in the, you know, in the large arena where the Caps and the Wizards play, and now, you know, they can't even fill up their local gym.
No. No, and that's exactly right. I got to ask you, the Tiger Woods effect, what has it had, not just on attendance, it's obvious you can see it, what's it had in terms of the money side, the corporate side?
Oh, it's so significant. Golf has been interesting to watch because they're making so much money on the corporate side. Corporate spending is way up. They found a way with golf where if you sponsor a tournament, you actually have to buy network time that aligns with the tournament that you're showing. So it really gives you the opportunity not just to say, all right, my brand is going to be highlighted during play with, you know, however I'm activating it with signage or whatever else, but I'm also going to be dominant on the airwaves across the board. So that's all been good. But the problem golf has is, you know, recreationally, you know, participation has dropped significantly. You know, Dick's Sporting Goods almost went out of business because they bet so heavy on it. Nike pulled out of it altogether.
Right.
You know, guys like Tiger Woods, as much as, you know, pure golfers say, I don't care to watch Tiger. I don't know why they show him while he's not in contention, while other, you know, younger guys are in contention. Well, they're showing him because he drives people to the range. He drives people to the courses. And the reality is the Top Golf effect, you know, we still don't know if that's going to hold. It's only been a couple of years. So the effect that Tiger's had on the tour has been significant. And the way they're looking at it now isn't so much how do we cash in right now. They're really trying to make sure they don't make the same mistake that when he leaves again, you know, everybody takes off with him.
We knew that the Winter Olympics financially was not going to be great.
Uh-oh,
it turned out that there were a lot of problems along the way, just even with the coverage of the Olympics. Is Tokyo a line in the sand to let us know what direction the Olympics are actually going in?
It'll be interesting because Tokyo hasn't hosted a major live event in decades, right? And so the first thing they're actually going to have the Rugby World Cup coming up here. That's going to be their test run for the Olympics. So we'll see how they do with that. The funny one is, I think I read this correctly, that Paris is already $2 billion or something over their budget. It's still 2024, which are any of us surprised that there's going to be corruption in France overspending against their budget?
Right.
But and they haven't even bought the land for the Olympic Village yet. So it's one of those things where you just fully expect it to happen, but you see the headline and it makes you laugh.
I mean, this is one of the reasons why you've talked so often here about people. Hey, if you want to invest a little bit of money, invest money in. And look, I'm a football, basketball, baseball, hockey, golf guy, whatever. But I completely get why you tell us why. Hey, look, invest a little bit in MLS, for example,
because
they've got
MLS,
a beautiful formula going where they don't have oversized stadiums. They've got great atmospheres. The games don't, or the matches don't take that long, and people have fun.
And they get involved when things go south. So Columbus,
yes.
The situation in Columbus is awful, right? But
right. The
league's involved, and they're going to move that team to Austin. And if they don't, then they're going to solve it in the next year. They're not going to have, you know, a lame duck franchise. I mean, you look at what Major League Baseball did with the Expos. That was a disaster. It was a total disaster. And the same thing happened with the Supersonics moving out of Seattle. At least MLS has enough control from the top that they're making sure that these things don't happen. And look, the reality is I think the leagues that people are investing in the most and have the most growth are the MLS and the NBA. I mean, the reality is if the NCAA changes do eventually come, and I think that's, you know, coming sooner rather than later, the ability for them to create a G League and really start to saturate, you know, smaller markets with, you know, teams that are integrated with what's happening with the big club. You know, players are going up and down with more regularity than what's happening with, you know, minor league baseball. I just think the NBA, you know, the sky is the limit for that league. It's become an international game. They're going to be able to make it even more localized. You can see the ratings are going up while everybody else's are going down. Its sponsorship spending is basically maxed out. If you want to be a major sponsor for the NBA, you can't. There's no spots left for you.
I'm sure we can't get an accurate gauge on what kind of market Vegas actually is, but a year ago today they had no players. they are Pacific Division champions. They swept the Kings in four games. They're into the conference semifinal. Is this as interesting and in some ways as remarkable a sports story as we have seen, not only from the on ice but to the management, to the ticket part?
I think the NHL got a little over-aggressive with their draft, and now you have Seattle making the same demands, right? Hey,
right.
Look, if Vegas gets to be the 2 seed, we get to be the 2 seed in our first year. What's fascinating about Vegas, I've been to a few games out there. I've been to the environment and seen it. It's still a really transient fan base. So, you know, when you go to the games, even with such a hot team, during the regular season, a very large chunk of the fans were from the opposing team, which makes sense because if you're going to go on a road trip to watch the team play, you're going to go to Vegas, right? You're going to fly out of Edmonton in February to go to Las Vegas. So I don't know what the staying power is on it. The only reason I'm cynical about it is because, you know, you and I have been around long enough. We remember when the Anaheim Ducks were the hottest thing in town for 10 years, and they were so hot that they burned every bridge locally that there was. And you know, there's been a lot of those scenarios where you've seen those teams, you know, that are kind of a flash in the pan and didn't hold on. And you know, for every one of those, there's also a San Jose Sharks, which is one of the best game day environments going, which makes no sense to me because San Jose is not a very big sports town. I mean, mostly it's based in San Francisco. But hockey fans from the East Coast would be shocked if they went to a Sharks game. People do not stand up during the game, and they're all sold out. So I don't know with Vegas. I think they're going to make it awfully difficult for Seattle to be appeased by the NHL.
Right. Well, in fact, you know, my opinion, and you can tell me if I'm wrong about this, I felt like, at least in my research, San Jose has always just kind of stuck to what they're supposed to do. And not only that, they've always treated their fan bases really well, as opposed to some groups that when they achieve success, then they got a little cocky with the success, raised the ticket prices, did this, did that, went for the quick cash money grab. San Jose didn't do that. Am I right or wrong about that?
No, that's exactly. So the Anaheim Ducks are regularly talked about in the NHL circles, at least when I was there 10, 15 years ago, about how not to do things when you're on top, right? They basically were so hot that they felt untouchable and that was never going to change. And some of the moves they made on the business side made it very difficult for them to maintain a fan base when they, you know, eventually came back down. I mean, the leagues are all based on parity. Yeah, there are some Patriots-level dynasties in some leagues, but they're all built to not stay good forever. And, you know, it's just fascinating to see that. I'll be interested to see what happens with the Winnipeg Jets, too. They're actually really trying to tread that line. They've got a very, very interested and engaged fan base. But the reality is they don't have a lot of corporate dollars there, so that fan base has to stay up. They are one of the teams that relies on ticket sales. And, you know, that won't be new again in a couple of years. So, you know, all those forces that forced the team out of Winnipeg in the first place, are they gonna put enough pressure on it in the second time around? So who knows? And that's just the interesting play with hockey right now, right? Is you have these moves that some of them go well. Some of them turn into the Arizona Coyotes.
Coyotes.
You know?
Yes. Yes, I saw their arena just 3.5-4 months ago. So.
beautiful arena, a beautiful place, but that's not a hockey town, and it never, ever will be.
No, never will be.
No, Tony, like Miami.
Exactly. And, you know, and that's the interesting part. Miami and baseball, that's one where I can understand why Major League Baseball wanted to give it a shot there, but it doesn't work there.
No, it does not work. And that new stadium, I mean, he basically fleeced the local government on that. That's a story for another day. But
yes,
it's one of those things where you wonder who's in the room saying, yeah, let's award a franchise to Miami. Because
well,
that's going to work
there
out.
Wasn't you and me in the room, because we would have given him different advice. Tony, absolute pleasure. Even with the cold, you were still 98 on the slow gun.
I like it.
Thanks, my friend. It's always, always great to hear. Can't wait to talk to you again.
Absolutely. We'll talk to you guys soon.
Celebrate America with America's Best Value Summer Event at Sunbury Motors Kia. I want to see you in the air. Sunbury Motors Kia. As summer heats up, so do the special offers at Sunbury Motors Kia. The best season of the year deserves America's best value. And there's no better value than 20 new 2018 Kias for under 20 grand. You heard right. Sunbury Motors Kia has 20 new 2018 Kia Rios, Optimus Souls, and Fortes for under 20 grand. But that's not all. Get 0% financing for 66 months on most 2018 Kia models. Plus, I'll include the industry-leading 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain warranty. Celebrate America with America's Best Value Summer Event at Sunbury Motors Kia. Routes 11 to 15 in Hummel's Wharf and online at sunburymotorskia.com.
Offer expires 6/30/18. Financing offers exclude Kia Stinger, Kadenza, and Rio, and are for qualified buyers through KMF Financing. Warranty is limited powertrain warranty. For details, see retailer or go to kia.com.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
And this week is Best of Week here on the Steve Jones Show on WKOK and Sean Carey, Sunbury Motors Ford Lincoln Hyundai, and the North 4th Street Auto Plaza Sunbury and Sunbury Motors Kia on the Strip, Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Looking ahead to tomorrow's Best of Show. Got replays with John McMullen from ESPN New Jersey. Some NFL talk with John, which we had back in April following the NFL draft. And we'll also dive into the College Basketball Rice Commission report with Mike DeCourcy of Big Ten Network. And we will wrap up our Best of Week with one of the great interviews we've had in the history of the show with Penn State football legend Mike Reed. Well, the Phillies last night avoided the sweep, shut out the Yankees 3-0. Zach Eflin, great performance. Went undefeated in the month of June, went 5-0 with a 1.76 ERA. All Phillies needed last night was a three-run homer by Rhys Hoskins, so they will take that into a four-game weekend set against the Washington Nationals beginning tonight. Aaron Nola will get the ball for the Phillies for the second time in four games. Right-hander Tanner Roark will be on the mound for Washington. He will make his second consecutive start against Philly. Aaron Nola comes in tonight with a record of 9-2 with a 2.58 ERA. He is well on his way to his first All-Star appearance. He pitched six strong innings against the Nationals last Saturday. Nola has pitched at least six innings in 13 of his 16 starts this season. Nola has faced the Nationals 11 times in his career, the most of any opponent for the fourth-year major leaguers. We'll have On Deck for you tonight beginning at 6:30 with Jim Jackson. Scott Fransky, Larry Anderson with the call, 7:05 on 1070 AM. Last summer, a book was released called The Pride of the Yankees about that great movie on the life of Lou Gehrig, written by New York Times writer Richard Sandmeyer. Back in the spring, it was released in paperback. Here's Steve's conversation with Rich Sandmeyer.
Richard, thank you so very much for your time. Appreciate it. Your book is an absolutely fascinating read.
Thank you very much. It's good to hear.
Well, let's start with this. First of all, the concept of it. What brought you to write about this movie and do it at this particular moment in time?
Well, it almost didn't happen at this moment in time. I had been noodling around with the idea for a while, inspired by first the resonance of Gehrig's original speech, and then getting more focused on Cooper's version. And then if you get into the Cooper version, then you start getting into the whole movie. So I had a couple of versions of a proposal that didn't work out, and finally with a new agent in 2015, we fixed it up and we sold it. So, but you could say I'd gotten obsessed with the movie.
Cooper's version, of course, is the one that the Hollywood puts out there. You had to do a lot of research because the papers were a little bit all over the place as to what the version was. But the luckiest man in the face of the earth is not the last line. It actually is almost at the beginning of the speech, correct?
Correct. It's the second line of the speech. But, you know, even that is not an absolute certainty, because if you look at what's left of the original newsreel of Gehrig delivering the speech, he goes up there without anything in hand. So he's either ad-libbing it, speaking from notes, or speaking from memory of notes or conversation he had with Eleanor or anybody else who contributed. The version that we view as the official version of the speech was something that Eleanor gave to Samuel Goldwyn when she was insisting that the movie speech be the same as the original that Lou gave. And she said, "I am giving this to you from memory." Her memory was had to be somewhat off, because what she offered up was different in certain ways from the newspaper accounts. Nobody was prepared to do a transcript because nobody was prepared for him to make a speech. So we do know that the luckiest man line, and you know, you've heard about a bad break, and that stuff comes directly from the newsreel. But it's hard to tell what truly was the actual original version.
movies can take artistic license. I'll give you an example of a sports movie that does, The Greatest Game Ever Played, with Shia LaBeouf, about Francis Ouimet. And it shows Ouimet on the 18th hole of the playoff with Ted Ray and Harry Vardon, and handshaking, he knocks in the par putt to win. In reality, he won the playoff by 5 shots. What artistic license is taken in this movie based on your meticulous research?
Well, you know, Eleanor was reading the various scripts as they were being written, and she would send letters to Goldwyn, or to Goldwyn through her agent, Christy Walsh, and she would say, "Well, you know, you can portray our wedding the way you want, but Lou's parents weren't there; they were there in the movie." She said, you can't have Miller Huggins, the Yankee manager, sign Lou to a contract wearing a suit in the Yankee office. That would have been Ed Barrow. Well, that's the way it was in the movie. She sort of won a battle where she said, well, you can't have Lou hit 400 runs in a World Series game. Well, that was changed, if not directly, indirectly, to the scene where Lou promises to hit 200 runs in a World Series game for the paralyzed the kid with polio, right, in the hospital. So she, and I have about 4 or 5 letters that each contain 8 to 10 things where she was in part showing off her baseball knowledge. What's true about the movie is that she was a baseball fan, and she certainly learned more from Lou. And she would try to say, listen, we have to make this as credible as possible, because there'll be all sorts of press people out there critical of whenever we make a big whopper. Because, you know, back then, 1942, 41, when she was started writing these letters, the sports film genre barely existed. So people weren't prepared for anything like this. So if the New York sports writers saw all these errors, they were going to pounce. I think only one pounced a little bit. But I think she helped steer them away from big mistakes.
And in the end, I guess she was pleased with the outcome, including the portrayal of Teresa Wright, and she wasn't sure about Teresa Wright originally playing her, correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, put it this way. Teresa Wright was about 18 years younger than Gary Cooper. She'd only done two other movies. Of course, in all three of her first movies, she was nominated for Academy Award and won one of them. I think she had to grow accustomed to Teresa Wright doing it, because I think she favored someone like Barbara Stanwyck, who'd been with Cooper and Meet John Doe. But I think when you see Teresa Wright's work, you see someone who acts maturely beyond her years, who clearly made a very credible helpmate to Cooper as Eleanor, and a very supportive, a little bit of a teasing relationship. But, you know, Cooper, who could make an emotion in his heart clear with just the flick of an eye, sometimes had these wonderful broad smiles when Teresa Wright was in his presence. It was acting. I'm sure he liked her, but, you know, it was clear that they naturally, and from direction and the script, clearly showed that they were a terrific couple. And I think what Eleanor liked about that was, yes, this was going to help perpetuate Lou's image as a great husband. She also enjoyed a very different portrayal of her by Blythe Danner 35 years later, in a movie that was based on Eleanor's own memoir, and Eleanor counseled Blythe to not be as sweet a character as Teresa played her, but I'm a tough cookie, play me more like a tough cookie.
Gary Cooper, of course, he was under contract to Sam Goldwyn, so despite what they wanted to put out as to who would play Gary, he was going to be the choice. He's right-handed, Lou Gehrig's left-handed. What did it take for him to play the part?
Well, he undertook 6 weeks of lessons from the former National League batting champion Lefty O'Doul, got some other help from Bill Dickey, and you know, there's been a legend that's grown up around the movie that Cooper failed at becoming a lefty, so they filmed all the scenes right-handed and flipped the film. Well, you know, the best available person to analyze this, a curator at the Hall of Fame who looked to this film frame by frame, and who's an expert in the way buttons are put onto uniforms, expert on, you know, the labels on vats. He said they, in order to do the flipping, it's more than just, you know, having Cooper bat right-handed and run to third base instead of first base, then have it flipped. It means everybody, the front of everybody's uniform has to have the letters backwards, the numbers have to be backwards. Everybody, not just Cooper. So, he felt that in only one instance, in the minor league montage of scenes where Lou is in Hartford, it's very clear that the Cooper could not learn to throw left-handed, which may be the hardest task of all. And so that was flipped. But, you know, I happen to think that, you know, here's a guy, 40 years old, never played baseball before. I think he did okay. I think, you know, the swing is not Gehrig, but in 1942 there wasn't that great a demand that our actors be great athletes. Nowadays, someone with Cooper's lack of baseball skills would never be cast. We've seen Kevin Costner, we've seen Robert Redford, we've seen Chadwick Boseman in 42. We've seen all these athletic actors. You can't have someone like that, and now they're making a movie about Lou Gehrig based on the biography by Jonathan Eich. So it'll be interesting to see the athletic skills of the actor they choose to play Lou.
Sam Goldwyn, though, is not a baseball fan. I think it's safe to say, based on reading this book, he was not a baseball fan. He'd rather see the romantic angle played up. So, in the end, was Goldwyn pleased with the balance that he wanted to see between baseball, which is, of course, part of the heart and soul of Gehrig, and also the romantic part that he thought was essential to a movie?
Well, look, he got 11 Academy Award nominations. It was his best. It grossed more than any other film that he had up to that point. So, yeah, I have to say he was pleased by that. You know, there are incidents even early on where he was fed up with what he saw in his script, and he said, "I'm going to cut Babe Ruth's part in half. I'm going to not even hire any of these Yankee ball players." He was very temperamental, but I think he had to be pleased by the reception. The reviews were, I'd say, 85% positive. There was a little bit of criticism that, there isn't much drama in there. But what they were talking about was traditional sports drama. There was no bottom-of-the-ninth home run. There was no great catch. The biggest drama on the field was whether Gehrig would hit that second home run for the kid with polio. And that's the way it was supposed to be. The climax was the speech. And there aren't many sports movies with a better climax than that.
No, I agreed. Eleanor Gehrig, though, was either at the soundstage or an extra when he delivered the speech, right? Her emotions came through?
Yeah. You know, movie magic such as it was in 1942, you're led to believe that Cooper delivered the speech on field, and they were using Wrigley Field in Los Angeles, the other Wrigley Field, as their as the location for the baseball action. But for the 2 or 3 minutes where Cooper is delivering the speech, he's on the soundstage, and Goldwyn invites her to come and watch, and it's, you know, in a dark. Everything is dark except for the lights focusing on Cooper, and people hear her crying in the background, and she leaves because she knows, you know, that kind of noise will get picked up. And but there's every reason to believe she loved the scene. It was not necessarily an impersonation, but it was a great suggestion of what was available to watch of Gehrig on the newsreel. And you saw the tears, you saw the watery eyes, you see him wiping his face. Cooper, like I said, Cooper can convey emotion with just the slightest movement of his eyes. And if you notice, there is a point, you have to watch very, very closely, but there is a quick cut where it's clear that, you know, Cooper is on field at Wrigley Field getting ready to make the speech. Then there's a cut that makes it very clear that he's in the soundstage, because the backdrop goes from the real players in behind him to the newsreel.
And so those from our generation, Wrigley Field was the site of the old Home Run Derby that was on TV. That Wrigley Field.
It was, and the first home of the Los Angeles Angels.
Yeah, that's right. First home of the LA Angels.
But, But you know, the funny thing about Home Run Derby is it was played in after the season in front of an empty stadium.
That's right.
You know, they didn't even think of bringing people in. I mean, yeah, it was the fall in L.A., but yeah, the players were in there in their uniforms. It was an empty place, but it was so wonderfully hokey. And it was, you know, Wrigley Field was a place, a go-to stadium for a lot of sitcoms. So it was a pretty popular stadium in its time. It no longer exists, but there it is.
When Gary goes overseas during World War II, a soldier shocked him with a request, and it turned out to be something that, in subsequent appearances overseas, he stuck with, and that request was the speech.
Well, yeah, Cooper had gone on a USO tour where he was basically just doing a comedy act, some old Jack Benny sketches with a couple of actresses and an accordionist. And one day in Port Moresby in the South Pacific, one soldier shouts out something like, "Hey, Coop, how about the speech from the Gehrig film?" And, he's not sitting around. You know, an actor doesn't necessarily keep all his lines in his head from previous films. He'd gone on to, he must have made at least two films since then. This is the fall of 43, so it's more than a year and a half since the movie came out. And he says, "Well, give me a few minutes. I got to go into my tent." And it's raining. It's I think it's monsoonal season in the South Pacific. And he says, "I got to write it down." And so he wrote down what he could remember, and he delivered it. And it was the stunned silence of most likely thousands of soldiers, many of whom probably thought, "Well, I may not survive," and they must have identified in some way with Gehrig, who died before his time of a tragic disease that nobody could understand at that time. So in each of the stops that Cooper made throughout the tour, ending in Sydney, Australia, he delivered the speech, and there was, at least according to him, there aren't too many accounts of this, at least according to him, there was a similarly respectful reaction to it, because he assumed, and maybe it's more than an assumption, that they had seen the movie on the base or wherever they were stationed, and they understood it. And, you know, if you recall in the book, the Damon Runyon wrote an introduction to the film, a scroll after the credits, that very short, but it placed Gehrig in sort of the pantheon of soldiers who had lost their lives on the battlefields. And America was in July of 42 when the movie came out. America was just eight months into its involvement. So I think the soldiers felt some sort of kinship with him, and Cooper unexpectedly was able to do something that he never did with another movie. You know, how many times does an actor get to deliver memorable lines from a movie that people had seen a year and a half ago, or had been released a year and a half before?
And it turned out Gary Cooper himself had cancer, and I want to say it was January of 61, Richard.
Yeah.
He
mm-hmm.
delivers his final public appearance at the Friars Club in Los Angeles, and he was renowned for the running joke on him. The stereotype was Gary Cooper, his best line was, "Yep."
Yeah.
And so he was asked to obviously say a few words because it was a tribute to him, and he links Gary to himself.
Yeah, it's like all of old Hollywood, which wasn't quite old Hollywood then, but Jack Benny, George Burns, Greer Garson, Audrey Hepburn, they're all there, and they all, it's sort of a gentle roast, except for Milton Berle. Milton Berle was out of his mind that day. But for some reason, Carl Sandburg was there making fun of Gary Cooper. So Cooper, he had bone cancer, and the cancer traveled to his bones, and he was in some pain. He still looked good, and this would be his last public appearance. At this point, his family had not told him he was terminal, which, as his daughter told me, is the basic personal parallel between he and Gehrig, whose wife didn't tell him exactly how dire it was early on. And so he goes to the hotel, and it's a big ballroom. It's packed. It's a charitable, it's a fundraiser. And Billy Wilder, his friend, had written the speech with him, and he actually carried the speech up to the podium, as opposed to Gehrig, who carried no speech at all with him. And it's very humble. It's very thankful. And at the very end, he said, "Well, if anybody thinks I'm the luckiest man in the world, I say, yep." And that's the last thing he ever said publicly. And, shortly, 4 months later, he was dead.